of Lem's iron grip. "It's me," she shouted. "Harwin, it's me. Don't you know me? Don't you?" The tears came, and she found herself weeping like a babe, just like some stupid little girl. "Harwin, it's me." Harwin's eyes went from her face to the flayed man on her doublet. "How do you know me?" he said, frowning suspiciously. "The flayed man? Who are you? Some serving boy to Lord Leech?" For a moment she did not know how to answer. She'd had so many names. Had she only dreamed Arya Stark? "I'm a girl," she sniffed. "I was Lord Bolton's cupbearer, but he was going to leave me for the goat, so I ran off with Gendry and Hot Pie. You have to know me. You used to lead my pony when I was little." His eyes went wide. "Gods be good," he said in a choked voice. "Arya underfoot?" "Lem, let go of her. She broke my nose." Lem dumped her unceremoniously to the floor. "Who in Seven Hells is she supposed to be?" "The Hand's daughter." Harwin went to one knee before her. "Arya Stark of Winterfell."
Bran. Something about the way the raven screamed sent a shiver running up Bran's spine. "I'm almost a man grown," he had to remind himself. "I have to be brave now." But the air was sharp and cold and full of fear. Even Summer was afraid. The fur on his neck was bristling. Shadows stretched against the hillside, black and hungry. All the trees were bowed and twisted by the weight of ice they carried. Some hardly looked like trees at all, buried from root to crown in frozen snow. They huddled on the hill like giants, monstrous and misshapen creatures hunched against the icy wind. "They are here," the ranger drew his longsword.
"Where?"
Mira's voice was hushed. "Close. I don't know. Somewhere." The raven shrieked again.
"Hodor," whispered Hodor.
He had his hands tucked up beneath his armpits. Icicles hung from the brown briar of his beard, and his moustache was a lump of frozen snot, glittering redly in the light of sunset.
"Those wolves are close as well," Bran warned them. "The ones that have been following us. Summer can smell them whenever we're downwind."
"Wolves are the least of our woes," said Coldhands. "We have to climb. It will be dark soon. You would do well to be inside before night comes. Your warmth will draw them."
He glanced to the west, where the light of the setting sun could be seen dimly through the trees like the glow of a distant fire.
"Is this the only way in?" asked Mira.
"The back door is 3 leagues north, down a sinkhole."
That was all he had to say. Not even Hodor could climb down into a sinkhole with Bran heavy on his back, and Jojen could no more walk 3 leagues than run 1,000. Mira eyed the hill above.
"The way looks clear."
"Looks," the ranger muttered darkly. "Can you feel the cold? There's something here. Where are they?"
"Inside the cave," suggested Mira.
"The cave is warded. They cannot pass." The ranger used his sword to point. "You can see the entrance there, halfway up, between the weirwoods, that cleft in the rock."
"I see it," said Bran.
Ravens were flying in and out. Hodor shifted his weight.
"Hodor!"
"A fold in the rock, that's all I can see," said Mira.
"There's a passage there, steep and twisty at first. A runnel through the rock. If you can reach it, you'll be safe."
"What about you?"
"The cave is warded."
Mira studied the cliff and the hillside.
"It can't be more than 1,000 yards from here to there."
"No," thought Bran.
"But all those yards are upward."
The hill was steep and thickly wooded. The snow had stopped 3 days ago, but none of it had melted. Beneath the trees, the ground was blanketed in white, still pristine and unbroken.
"No one's here," said Bran bravely. Look at the snow. There are no footprints.
The White Walkers go lightly on the snow, the ranger said. You'll find no prints to mark their passage. A raven descended from above to settle on his shoulder. Only a dozen of the big black birds remained with them. The rest had vanished along the way. Every dawn when they arose, there had been fewer of them.
Come, the bird squawked. Come, come.
The three-eyed crow, thought Bran. The green's here.
It's not so far, he said. A little climb, and we'll be safe. Maybe we can have a fire.
All of them were cold and wet and hungry, except the ranger, and Jojen Reed was too weak to walk unaided.
You go, Mira Reed bent down beside her brother. He was settled in the bole of an oak, eyes closed, shivering violently. What little of his face could be seen beneath his hood and scarf was as colourless as the surrounding snow, but breath still puffed faintly from his nostrils whenever he exhaled. Mare had been carrying him all day. Food and fire will set him right again, Bran tried to tell himself, though he wasn't sure it would.
I can't fight and carry Jojen both. The climb's too steep, Mira was saying. Hodor, you take Bran up to that cave.
Hodor!
Hodor clapped his hands together.
Jojen just needs to eat, Bran said miserably.
It had been 12 days since the elk had collapsed for the third and final time, since Cold Hands had knelt beside it in the snowbank and murmured a blessing in some strange tongue as he slit its throat. Bran wept like a little girl when the bright blood came rushing out. He had never felt more like a cripple than he did then, watching helplessly as Mira Reed and Cold Hands butchered the brave beast who had carried them so far. He told himself he would not eat, that it was better to go hungry than to feast upon a friend. But in the end he'd eaten twice, once in his own skin and once in Summer's. As gaunt and starved as the elk had been, the steaks the ranger carved from him had sustained them for 7 days, until they finished the last of them huddled over a fire in ruins of an old hill fort.
"He needs to eat,"
Mira agreed, smoothing her brother's brow.
"We all do, but there's no food here. Go!"
Bran blinked back a tear and felt it freeze upon his cheek. Cold Hands took Hodor by the arm.
"The light is fading. If they're not here now, they will be soon. Come!"
Wordless for once, Hodor slapped the snow off his legs and ploughed upward through the snowdrifts with Bran upon his back. Cold Hands stalked beside them, his blade in a black hand. Summer came after. In some places the snow was higher than he was, and the big direwolf had to stop and shake it off after plunging through the thin crust. As they climbed, Bran turned awkwardly in his basket to watch as Mira slid an arm beneath her brother to lift him to his feet.
"He's too heavy for her. She's half-starved. She's not as strong as she was."
She clutched her frog spear in her other hand, jabbing the tines into the snow for a little more support. Mira had just begun to struggle up the hill, half dragging and half carrying a little brother, when Hodor passed between two trees, and Bran lost sight of them. The hill grew steeper. Drifts of snow cracked under Hodor's boots. Once a rock moved beneath his foot, and he slid backwards and almost went tumbling back down the hill. The ranger caught him by the arm and saved him.
"Hodor," said Hodor.
Every gust of wind filled the air with fine white powder that shone like glass in the last light of day. Ravens flapped around them. One flew ahead and vanished inside the cave.
"Only 80 yards now," Bran thought. "That's not far at all."
Summer stopped suddenly at the bottom of the steep stretch of unbroken white snow. The direwolf turned his head, sniffed the air, then snarled. Fur bristling, he began to back away.
"Hodor, stop," said Bran. "Hodor, wait!"
Something was wrong. Summer smelled it, and so did he.
"Something bad, something close. Hodor, no, go back!"
Cold Hands was still climbing, and Hodor wanted to keep up. "Hodor, Hodor, Hodor," he grumbled loudly to drown out Bran's complaints. His breathing had grown laboured. Pale mist filled the air. He took a step, then another. The stair was almost waist-deep, and the slope was very steep. Hodor was leaning forward, grasping at rocks and trees with his hands as he climbed. Another step, another. The snow Hodor disturbed slid downhill, starting a small avalanche behind them.
60 yards. Bran craned himself sideways to better see the cave.
Then he saw something else.
A fire!
In the little cleft between the weirwood trees was a flickering glow, a ruddy light calling through the gathering gloom.
"Look, someone!" Hodor screamed. He twisted, stumbled, fell.
Bran felt the world slide sideways as the big stable boy spun violently around. A jarring impact drove the breath from him. His mouth was full of blood, and Hodor was thrashing and rolling, crushing the crippled boy beneath him.
Something has hold of his leg.
For half a heartbeat, Bran thought maybe a root had gotten tangled around his ankle, until the root moved. A hand, he saw, as the rest of the white came bursting from beneath the snow. Hodor kicked at it, slamming a snow-covered heel full into the thing's face. But the dead man did not even seem to feel it. Then the two of them were grappling, punching, and clawing at each other, sliding down the hill. Snow filled Bran's mouth and nose as they rolled over, but in half a heartbeat he was rolling up again. Something slammed against his head, a rock or a chunk of ice or a dead man's fist, he could not tell, and he found himself out of his basket, sprawled across the hillside, spitting snow, his gloved hand full of hair that he'd torn from Hodor's head. All around him, whites were rising from beneath the snow.
2, 3, 4,
Bran lost count. They surged up violently, amidst sudden clouds of snow. Some wore black cloaks, some ragged skins, some nothing. All of them had pale flesh and black hands. Their eyes glowed like pale blue stars. Three of them descended on the ranger. Bran saw Cold Hands slash one across the face. The thing kept right on coming, driving him back into the arms of another. Two more were going after Hodor, lumbering clumsily down the slope. Mira was going to climb right into this, Bran realized with a sick sense of helpless terror. He smashed the snow and shouted out a warning. Something grabbed hold of him. That was when his shout became a scream. Bran filled a fist with snow and threw it, but the white did not so much as blink. A black hand fumbled at his face, another at his belly. Its fingers felt like iron.
"He's going to pull my guts out."
But suddenly, Summer was between them. Bran glimpsed skin tear like cheap cloth, heard the splintering of bone. He saw a hand and wrist rip loose, pale fingers wriggling, the sleeve, faded black rough spun.
"Black," he thought. "He's wearing black. He was one of the watch."
Summer flung the arm aside, twisted, and sank his teeth into the dead man's neck, under the chin. When the big grey wolf wrenched free, he took most of the creature's throat out in an explosion of pale, rotten meat. The severed hand was still moving. Bran rolled away from it. On his belly, clawing at the snow, he glimpsed the trees above, pale and snow-cloaked, the orange glow between.
50 yards.
If he could drag himself 50 yards, they could not get him. Damp seeped through his gloves as he clutched at roots and rocks, crawling toward the light.
"A little farther, just a little farther, and you can rest beside the fire."
The last light had vanished from amongst the trees by then. Night had fallen. Cold Hands was hacking and cutting at the circle of dead men that surrounded him. Summer was tearing at the one that he'd brought down, its face between his teeth. No one was paying any mind to Bran. He crawled a little higher, dragging his useless legs behind him.
"If I can reach that cave..." "Hodor,"
came a whimper from somewhere down below. And suddenly he was not Bran, the broken boy, crawling through the snow. Suddenly he was Hodor, halfway down the hill, with a white raking at his eyes. Roaring, he came lurching to his feet, throwing the thing violently aside. It went to one knee, began to rise again. Bran ripped Hodor's long sword from his belt. Deep inside, he could hear poor Hodor whimpering still. But outside, he was 7 feet of fury, with old iron in his hand. He raised the sword and brought it down upon the dead man, grunting as the blade sheared through wet wool and rusted mail and rotted leather, biting deep into the bones and flesh beneath. "Hodor!" he bellowed, and slashed again. This time he took the white's head off at the neck, and for half a moment he exulted, until a pair of dead hands came groping blindly for his throat. Bran backed away, bleeding, and Mira Reed was there, driving her frog spear deep into the white's back. "Hodor!" Bran roared again, waving her uphill. "Hodor! Hodor!" Jojen was twisting feebly where she laid him down. Bran went to him, dropped the longsword, gathered the boy into Hodor's arm, and lurched back to his feet. "Hodor!" he bellowed. Mira led the way back up the hill, jabbing at the whites when they came near. The things could not be hurt, but they were slow and clumsy. "Hodor!" Hodor said with every step. "Hodor! Hodor!" He wondered what Mira would think if he should suddenly tell her that he loved her. Up above them, flaming figures were dancing in the snow. "The whites," Bran realized. "Someone set the whites on fire." Summer was snarling and snapping as he danced around the closest, a great ruin of a man wreathed in swirling flame.
"He shouldn't get so close. What's he doing?"
Then he saw himself, sprawled face down in the snow. Summer was trying to drive the thing away from him.
"What will happen if it kills me?"
the boy wondered.
"Will I be Hodor, for good or all? Will I go back into summer skin, or will I just be dead?"
The world moved dizzily around him. White trees, black sky, red flames, everything was whirling, shifting, spinning. He felt himself stumbling. He could hear Hodor screaming, "Hodor! Hodor! 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 Hodor!" A cloud of ravens was pouring from the cave, and he saw a little girl with a torch in hand, darting this way and that. For a moment, Bran thought it was his sister, Arya, madly, for he knew his little sister was 1,000 leagues away, or dead. And yet there she was, whirling, a scrawny thing, ragged, wild, her hair tangled. Tears filled Hodor's eyes and froze there. Everything turned inside out and upside down, and Bran found himself back inside his own skin, half buried in the snow. The burning white loomed over him, etched tall against the trees in their snowy shrouds. It was one of the naked ones Bran saw in the instant before the nearest tree shook off the snow that covered it and dropped it all down upon his head. The next he knew, he was lying on a bed of pine needles beneath a dark stone roof.
"The cave, I'm in the cave."
His mouth still tasted of blood where he'd bitten his tongue, but a fire was burning to his right, the heat washing over his face, and he had never felt anything so good. Summer was there sniffing round him, and Hodor soaking wet. Mira cradled Jojen's head in her lap, and the Arya thing stood over them, clutching her torch.
"The snow," Bran said. "It fell on me, buried me. Hid you. I pulled you out."
Mira nodded at the girl.
"It was her who saved us, though. The torch. Fire kills them." "Fire burns them. Fire is always hungry."
That was not Arya's voice, nor any child's. It was a woman's voice, high and sweet, with a strange music in it like none he had ever heard, and a sadness that he thought might break his heart. Bran squinted to see her better. It was a girl, but littler than Arya, her skin dappled like a doe's beneath a cloak of leaves. Her eyes were queer, large and liquid, gold and green, slitted like a cat's eyes.
No one has eyes like that.
Her hair was a tangled brown and red and gold, autumn colours with vines and twigs and withered flowers woven through it.
"Who are you?"
Mira Reed was asking. Bran knew.
"She's a child of the forest." He shivered, as much from wonderment as cold.
They had fallen into one of old Nan's tales.
"The first men named us children," the little woman said. "The giants called us Wodak Nagran, the squirrel people, because we were small and quick and fond of trees. But we are no squirrels, no children. Our name in the true tongue means those who sing the song of earth. Before your old tongue was ever spoken, we had sung our songs 10,000 years.
Mira said,
"You speak the common tongue now." "For him, the Bran boy, I was born in the time of the dragon, and for 200 years I walked the world of men, to watch and listen and learn. I might be walking still, but my legs were sore, and my heart was weary, so I turned my feet for home."
200 years, said Mira.
The child smiled.
"Men, they are the children."
"Do you have a name?" asked Bran.
"When I am needing one,"
she waved her torch toward the black crack in the back wall of the cave,
"our way is down. You must come with me now."
Bran shivered again.
"The ranger, he cannot come.
They'll kill him."
"No, they killed him long ago. Come now, it is warmer down deep, and no one will hurt you there. He is waiting for you."
"The three-eyed crow?" asked Mira.
"The green seer."
And with that she was off, and they had no choice but to follow. Mira helped Bran back up onto Hodor's back, though his basket was half crushed and wet from melting snow. Then she slipped an arm around her brother and shouldered him back onto his feet once more. His eyes opened.
"What?" he said. "Mira, where are we?"
When he saw the fire, he smiled.
"I had the strangest dream."
The way was cramped and twisty, and so low that Hodor soon was crouching. Bran hunched down as best he could, but even so the top of his head was soon scraping and bumping against the ceiling. Loose dirt crumbled at each touch and dribbled down into his eyes and hair, and once he smacked his brow on a thick white root growing from the tunnel wall, with tendrils hanging from it and spider webs between its fingers. The child went in front with the torch in hand, her cloak of leaves whispering behind her, but the passage turned so much that Bran soon lost sight of her. Then the only light was what was reflected off the passage walls. After they had gone down a little way, the cave divided, but one branch was dark as pitch, so even Hodor knew to follow the moving torch to the right. The way the shadows shifted made it seem as if the walls were moving too. Bran saw great white snakes slithering in and out of the earth around him, and his heart thumped in fear. He wondered if they had blundered into a nest of milk snakes or giant grave worms, soft and pale and squishy.
"Grave worms have teeth."
Hodor saw them too.
"Hodor,"
he whimpered, reluctant to go on. But when the girl child stopped to let them catch her, the torchlight steadied, and Bran realized that the snakes were only white roots, like the one he'd hit his head on.
"It's weirwood roots," he said. "Remember the art tree in the God's Wood, Hodor? The white tree with the red leaves? A tree can't hurt you."
"Hodor."
Hodor plunged ahead, hurrying after the child and her torch deeper into the earth. They passed another branching and another, then came into an echoing cavern as large as the great hall of Winterfell, with stone teeth hanging from its ceiling and more poking up through its floor. The child in the leafy cloak wound a path through them. From time to time she stopped and waved her torch at them impatiently. This way, it seemed to say. This way, faster. There were more side passages after that, more chambers, and Bran heard dripping water somewhere to his right. When he looked off that way, he saw eyes looking back at them, slitted eyes that glowed bright, reflecting back the torchlight.
More children, he told himself. The girl is not the only one.
But old Nan's tale of Gendel's children came back to him as well. The roots were everywhere, twisting through earth and stone, closing off some passages and holding up the roofs of others.
All the colour is gone, Bran realized suddenly.
The world was black soil and white wood. The heart tree at Winterfell had roots as thick around as a giant's legs, but these were even thicker, and Bran had never seen so many of them.
There must be a whole grove of weirwoods growing up above us.
The light dwindled again. Small as she was, the child who was not a child moved quickly when she wanted. As Hodor thumped after her, something crunched beneath his feet. His halt was so sudden that Mira and Jojen almost slammed into his back.
"Bones," said Bran. "It's bones."
The floor of the passage was littered with the bones of birds and beasts. But there were other bones as well, big ones that must have come from giants, and small ones that could have been from children. On either side of them, in niches carved from the stone, skulls looked down on them. Bran saw a bear skull and a wolf skull, half a dozen human skulls, and nearly as many giants. All the rest were small, queerly formed.
Children of the forest.
The roots had grown in and around and through them, every one. A few had ravens perched atop them, watching them pass with bright black eyes. The last part of their dark journey was the steepest. Hodor made the final descent on his ass, bumping and sliding downward in a clatter of broken bones, loose dirt and pebbles. The girl child was waiting for them, standing on one end of a natural bridge above a yawning chasm. Bran heard the sound of rushing water down below in the darkness.
An underground river. Do we have to cross? Bran asked, as the reeds came sliding down behind him.
The prospect frightened him. If Hodor slipped on that narrow bridge, they would fall and fall.
No, boy, the child said. Behind you.
She lifted a torch higher, and the light seemed to shift and change. One moment the flames burned orange and yellow, filling the cavern with a ruddy glow. Then all the colours faded, leaving only black and white. Behind them, Mira gasped. Hodor turned. Before them, a pale lord in ebon finery sat dreaming in a tangled nest of roots, a woven weirwood throne that embraced his withered limbs as a mother does a child. His body was so skeletal, and his clothes so rotted, that at first Bran took him for another corpse, a dead man propped up so long that the roots had grown over him, under him, and through him. What skin the corpse lord showed was white, save for a bloody blotch that crept up his neck onto his cheek. His white hair was fine and thin as root hair and long enough to brush against the earthen floor. Roots coiled around his legs like wooden serpents. One burrowed through his breeches into the desiccated flesh of his thigh to emerge again from his shoulder. A spray of dark red leaves sprouted from his skull, and grey mushrooms spotted his brow. A little skin remained, stretched across his face, tight and hard as white leather. But even that was fraying, and here and there the brown and yellow bone beneath was poking through.
"Are you the three-eyed crow?"
Bran heard himself say.
"A three-eyed crow should have three eyes. He has only one, and that one red."
Bran could feel the eyes staring at him, shining like a pool of blood in the torchlight. Where his other eye should have been, a thin white root grew from an empty socket down his cheek and into his neck.
"A crow?"
The pale lord's voice was dry. His lips moved slowly, as if they had forgotten how to form words.
Once, black of garb and black of blood.
The clothes he wore were rotten and faded, spotted with moss and eaten through with worms. But once they had been black.
I have been many things, Bran. Now I am as you see me, and now you will understand why her could not come to you, except in dreams. I have watched you for a long time, watched you with a thousand eyes and one. I saw your birth and that of your lord father before you. I saw your first step, heard your first word, was part of your first dream. I was watching when you fell, and now you are come to me at last, Brandon Stark. Though the hour is late.
I'm here, Bran said, only I'm broken. Will you fix me? My legs, I mean.
No, said the pale lord. That is beyond my powers.
Bran's eyes filled with tears.
We came such a long way.
The chamber echoed to the sound of the Black River.
You will never walk again, Bran,
the pale lips promised.
But you will fly.
John. White Tree. The village was named on Sam's old maps. John did not think it much of a village. Four tumble-down one-room houses of unmortared stone, surrounded by an empty sheepfold and a well. The houses were roofed with sod, the windows shuttered with ragged pieces of hide, and above them loomed the pale limbs and dark red leaves of a monstrous great weirwood. It was the biggest tree Jon Snow had ever seen, the trunk near 8 feet wide, the branches spreading so far that the entire village was shaded beneath its canopy. The size did not disturb him so much as the face, the mouth especially. No simple carved slash, but a jagged hollow large enough to swallow a sheep. Those are not sheep bones, though. Nor is that a sheep's skull in the ashes.
An old tree, Mormont sat his horse running. Old,
his raven agreed from his shoulder.
Old, old, old.
And powerful. John could feel the power. Thorin Smallwood dismounted beside the trunk, dark in his plate and mail.
Look at that face. Small wonder men feared them when they first came to Westeros. I'd like to take an axe to that bloody thing myself.
John said, my lord father believed that no man could tell a lie in front of a heart tree. The old gods know when men are lying.
My father believed the same, said the old bear. Let me have a look at that skull.
John dismounted. Slung across his back in a black leather shoulder sheath was Longclaw, the hand-and-a-half bastard blade the old bear had given him for saving his life. A bastard sword for a bastard, the men joked. The hilt had been fashioned new for him, adorned with a wolf's head pommel in pale stone, but the blade itself was Valyrian steel, old and light and deadly sharp. He knelt and reached a gloved hand down into the maw. The inside of the hollow was red with dried sap and blackened by fire. Beneath the skull he saw another, smaller, the jaw broken off. It was half buried in the ash and bits of bone. When he brought the skull to Mormont, the old bear lifted it in both hands and stared into the empty sockets.
The wildlings burn their dead. Well, we've always known that. I wish I'd asked them why, when there were still a few around to ask.
Jon Snow remembered the white rising, its eyes shining blue in the pale dead face. He knew why, he was certain.
Would that bones could talk, the old bear grumbled. This fellow could tell us much, how he died, who burned him and why, where the wildlings have gone?" He sighed. "The children of the forest could speak to the dead," it said, "but I can't." He tossed the skull back into the mouth of the tree, where it landed with a puff of fine ash. "Go to all these houses. Giant, get to the top of this tree. Have a look. I'll have the hounds brought up, too. Chance this time, trail will be fresher." His tone did not suggest that he held up much hope of the last. Two men went through each house to make certain nothing was missed. John was paired with Doer Edison Tollett, a squire grey of hair and thin as a pike, whom the other brothers called Dolorous Ed.
"Bad enough when the dead come walking," he said to John as they crossed the village. "Now the old bear wants some talking as well. No good will come of that, I'll warrant. And who's to say the bones wouldn't lie, eh? Why should death make a man truthful or even clever? The dead are likely dull fellows, full of tedious complaints. The ground's too cold. My gravestone should be larger. Why does he get more worms than I do?"
John had to stoop to pass through the low door. Within he found a packed dirt floor. There were no furnishings, no sign that people had lived here, but for some ashes beneath the smoke hole in the roof. "What a dismal place to live," he said.
"I was born in a house much like this," declared Dolorous Ed. "Those were my enchanted years, eh? Later I fell on hard times."
A nest of dry straw bedding filled one corner of the room. Ed looked at it with longing.
"I'd give all the gold in Castle Rock to sleep in a bed again."
"You call that a bed?"
"If it's softer than the ground and has a roof over it, I'll call it a bed, eh?"
Dolorous Ed sniffed the air.
"I smell dung."
The smell was very faint. "Old dung," said John. The house felt as though it had been empty for some time. Kneeling, he searched through the straw with his hands to see if anything had been concealed beneath, then made a round of the walls. It did not take very long. "There's nothing here." Nothing was what he had expected. White Tree was the fourth village they had passed, and it had been the same in all of them. The people were gone, vanished with their scant possessions and whatever animals they may have had. None of the villagers showed any sign of having been attacked. They were simply empty. "What do you think happened to them all?" John asked.
"Something worse than we can imagine," suggested Dolorous Ed. "Well, I might be able to imagine it, but I'd sooner not. Bad enough to know you're going to come to some awful end without thinking about it aforetime."
Two of the hounds were sniffing around the door as they re-emerged. Other dogs ranged through the village. Chet was cursing them loudly, his voice thick with the anger he never seemed to put aside. The light filtering through the red leaves of the weirwood made the boils on his face look even more inflamed than usual. When he saw John, his eyes narrowed. There was no love lost between them. The other houses had yielded no wisdom.
"Gone!"
cried Mormont's raven, flapping up into the weirwood to perch above them.
"Gone! Gone! Gone!"
"There were wildlings at White Tree only a year ago. Thorin Smallwood looked more a lord than Mormont did, clad in Sir Jeremy Riker's gleaming black mail and embossed breastplate. His heavy cloak was richly trimmed with sable and clasped with the crossed hammers of the Rikers, wrought in silver. Sir Jeremy's cloak once, but the White had claimed Sir Jeremy, and the Night's Watch wasted nothing.
"A year ago, Robert was king, and the realm was at peace," declared Jarman Buckwell, the square, stolid man who commanded the scouts.
"Much can change in a year's time."
"One thing hasn't changed," Sir Maladar Locke insisted. "Fewer wildlings mean fewer worries. I won't mourn, whatever's become of them. Raiders and murderers, a lot of them."
John heard a rustling from the red leaves above. Two branches parted, and he glimpsed a little man moving from limb to limb as easily as a squirrel. Bedwick,
stood no more than 5 feet tall, but the grey streaks in his hair showed his age. The other rangers called him Giant. He sat in the fork of the tree, over their heads, and said,
"There's water to the north, a lake might be, a few flint hills rising to the west, not very high, nothing else to see, my lords."
"We might camp here tonight," Smallwood suggested. The old bear glanced up, searching for a glimpse of sky through the pale limbs and red leaves of the weirwood.
"No," he declared. "Giant, how much daylight remains to us?"
3 hours, my lord."
"We'll press on north," Mormont decided. "If we reach this lake, we can make camp by the shore, perchance catch a few fish. John, fetch me a paper. It's past time I wrote to Maester Aemon."
John found the parchment, quill and ink in his saddlebag and brought them to the Lord Commander.
"At White Tree," Mormont scrawled, "the fourth village, all empty. The wildlings are gone. Find Tarly and see that he gets this on its way," he said as he handed John the message.
When he whistled, the raven came flapping down to land on his horse's head.
"Corn,"
the raven suggested, bobbing. The horse whickered. John mounted his garron, wheeled him about, and trotted off. Beyond the shade of the great weirwood, the men of the Night's Watch stood beneath lesser trees, tending their horses, chewing strips of salt beef, pissing, scratching, and talking. When the command was given to move out again, the talk died, and they climbed back into their saddles. Jarman Buckwell's scouts rode out first, with the vanguard under Thorin Smallwood heading the column proper. Then came the old bear with the main force, Sir Malador Locke with the baggage train and pack horses, and finally Sir Otten Withers and the rear guard. 200 men all told, with half again as many mounts. By day they followed game trails and stream beds, the rangers' roads, that led them ever deeper into the wilderness of leaf and root. At night they camped beneath a starry sky and gazed up at the comet. The Black Brothers had left Castle Black in good spirits, joking and trading tales, but of late the brooding silence of the wood seemed to have sombered them all. Jests had grown fewer and tempers shorter. No one would admit to being afraid. They were men of the Night's Watch, after all. But John could feel the unease. 4 empty villages, no wildlings anywhere, even the game seemingly fled. The haunted forest had never seemed more haunted. Even veteran rangers agreed. As he rode, John peeled off his glove to air his burned fingers. Ugly things. He remembered suddenly how he used to muss Arya's hair, his little stick of a sister. He wondered how she was faring. It made him a little sad to think he might never muss her hair again. He began to flex his hand, opening and closing the fingers. If he let his sword hand stiffen and grow clumsy, it might well be the end of him in you. A man needed his sword beyond the wall. John found Samwell Tarly with the other Stuarts watering his horses. He had 3 to tend, his own mount and 2 pack horses, each bearing a large wire and wicker cage full of ravens. The birds flapped their wings at John's approach and screamed at him through the bars. A few shrieks sounded suspiciously like words. "Have you been teaching them to talk?" he asked Sam. A few words. 3 of them can say snow." "One bird croaking my name was bad enough," said John, "and snow's nothing a black brother wants to hear about." Snow often meant death in the north.
"Was there anything in White Tree?"
"Bones, ashes, and empty houses." John handed Sam the roll of parchment. "The old bear wants word sent back to Aemon." Sam took the bird from one of the cages, stroked its feathers, attached the message, and said,
"Fly home now, brave one, home!"
The raven quacked something unintelligible back at him, and Sam tossed it into the air. Flapping, it beat its way skyward through the trees.
"I wish he could carry me with him."
"Still?"
"Well," said Sam, "yes, but I'm not as frightened as I was, truly. The first night, every time I heard someone getting up to make water, I thought it was wildlings creeping in to slit my throat. I was afraid that if I closed my eyes, I might never open them again. Only, well, dawn came after all."
He managed a wan smile.
"I may be craven, but I'm not stupid. I'm sore, and my back aches from riding and from sleeping on the ground, but I'm hardly scared at all. Look."
He held out a hand for John to see how steady it was.
"I've been working on my maps."
The world is strange, John thought. 200 brave men have left the wall, and the only one who was not growing more fearful was Sam, the self-confessed coward. "We'll make a ranger of you yet," he joked. "Next thing, you'll want to be an outrider like Gren. Shall I speak to the old bear?"
"Don't you dare."
Sam pulled up the hood of his enormous black cloak and clambered awkwardly back onto his horse. It was a plough horse, big and slow and clumsy, but better able to bear his weight than the little garrons the rangers rode.
"I had hoped we might stay the night in the village," he said wistfully. "It would be nice to sleep under a roof again."
"Too few roofs for all of us." John mounted again, gave Sam a parting smile, and rode off. The column was well underway, so he swung wide around the village to avoid the worst of the congestion. He had seen enough of Whitetree. Ghost emerged from the undergrowth, so suddenly that the Garen shied and reared. The White Wolf hunted well away from the line of march, but he was not having much better fortune than the forager Smallwood sent out after game. The woods were as empty as the villages, Dywin had told him one night around the fire. "We're a large party," John had said. "The game's probably been frightened away by all the noise we make on the march."
"Frightened away by something, no doubt," Dywin said.
Once the horse had settled, Ghost loped along easily beside him. John caught up to Mormont as he was wending his way around a hawthorn thicket.
"Is the bird away?"
the old bear asked. "Yes, my lord. Sam is teaching them to talk." The old bear snorted.
"Ha! He'll regret that. Damn things make a lot of noise, but they never say a thing worth hearing."
They rode in silence, until John said, "If my uncle found all these villages empty as well,
he would have made it his purpose to learn why,"
Lord Mormont finished for him.
"And it may well be someone or something did not want that known. Well, we'll be 300 when Corrin joins us. Whatever enemy waits out here will not find us so easy to deal with." "We will find them, John, I promise you."
"Or they will find us," thought John.
The Soiled Night. The night was unseasonably cool, even for autumn. A brisk wet wind was swirling down the alleys, stirring up the day's dust. A north wind and full of chill. Sir Aris Oakheart pulled up his hood to cover his face. It would not do for him to be recognized. A fortnight past, a trader had been butchered in the Shadow City, a harmless man who'd come to Dawn for fruit and found death instead of dates. His only crime was being from King's Landing. The mob would find a sterner foe in me. He would almost have welcomed an attack. His hand drifted down to brush lightly over the hilt on the longsword that hung half-hidden amongst the folds of his layered linen robes, the outer with its turquoise stripes and rows of golden suns, and the lighter orange one beneath. The Dornish garb was comfortable, but his father would have been aghast had he lived to see his son so dressed. He was a man of the Reach, and the Dornish were his ancient foes, as the tapestries at Old Oak bore witness. Arris only had to close his eyes to see them still. Lord Edgeron the Open-Handed, seated in splendour with the heads of 100 Dornishmen piled round his feet, the three leaves in the prince's pass pierced by Dornish spears, Alistair sounding his war horn with his last breath, Sir Oliver the Green Oak, all in white, dying at the side of the young dragon. Dorne is no fit place for any oak heart. Even before Prince Oberyn had died, the knight had been ill at ease whenever he left the grounds of Sunspear to walk the alleys of the Shadow City. He could feel eyes upon him everywhere he went, small black Dornish eyes regarding him with thinly veiled hostility. The shopkeepers did their best to cheat him at every turn, and sometimes he wondered whether the taverners were spitting in his drinks. Once a group of ragged boys began pelting him with stones until he drew his sword and ran them off. The Red Viper's death had inflamed the Dornish even more, though the streets had quieted a bit since Prince Doran had confined the sand snakes to a tower. Even so, to wear his white cloak openly in the Shadow City would be asking for attack. He had brought three with him, two of wool, one light and one heavy, the third of fine white silk. He felt naked without one hanging from his shoulders. "Better naked than dead," he told himself. "I am a Kingsguard still, even uncloaked. She must respect that. I must make her understand." He should never have let himself be drawn into this, but the singer said that love can make a fool of any man. Sunspear's Shadow City oft seemed deserted in the heat of the day, when only buzzing flies moved down the dusty streets. But once evening fell, the same streets came to life. Sir Arris heard faint music drifting through louvered windows as he passed below, and somewhere finger drums were beating out the quick rhythm of a spear dance, giving the night a pulse. Where three alleys met beneath the second of the winding walls, a pillow girl called down from a balcony. She was dressed in jewels and oil. He took a look at her, hunched his shoulders, and pushed on into the teeth of the wind. "We men are so weak, our bodies betray even the noblest of us." He thought of King Baelor the Blessed, who would fast to the point of fainting to tame the lusts that shamed him. Must he do the same? A short man stood in an arched doorway, grilling chunks of snake over a brazier, turning them with wooden tongs as they crisped. The pungent smell of his sauces brought tears to the knight's eyes. The best snake sauce had a drop of venom in it, he had heard, along with mustard seeds and dragon peppers. Myrcella had taken to Dornish food as quick as she had to her Dornish prince, and from time to time Sir Arris would try a dish or two to please her. The food seared his mouth and made him gasp for wine, and burned even worse coming out than it did going in. His little princess loved it, though. He had left her in her chambers, bent over a gaming table opposite Prince Tristan, pushing ornate pieces across squares of jade and carnelian and lapis lazuli. Myrcella's full lips had been slightly parted, her green eyes narrowed with concentration. Sivas, the game was called. It had come to the Planky Town on a trading galley from Volantis, and the orphans had spread it up and down the Greenblood. The Dornish court was mad for it. Sir Arris just found it maddening. There were 10 different pieces, each with its own attributes and powers, and the board would change from game to game, depending on how the players arrayed their home squares. Prince Tristan had taken to the game at once, and Myrcella had learned it so she could play with him. She was not quite 11, her betrothed 3 and 10. Even so, she had been winning more oft than not of late. Tristan did not seem to mind. The two children could not have looked more different, him with his olive skin and straight black hair, her pale as milk with a mop of golden curls, light and dark, like Queen Circe and King Robert. He prayed Myrcella would find more joy in her Dornish boy than her mother had found with her Stormlord. It made him feel uneasy to leave her, though she should be safe enough within the castle. There were only two doors that gave access to Myrcella's chambers in the Tower of the Sun, and Sir Aris kept two men on each, Lannister household guards, men who had come with them from King's Landing, battle-tested, tough, and loyal to the bone. Myrcella had her maids and Septa Eglantine as well, and Prince Tristan was attended by his sworn shield, Sir Gascoigne of the Greenblood. "No one will trouble her," he told himself, "and in a fortnight we shall be safely away." Prince Doran had promised as much, though Aris had been shocked to see how aged and infirm the Dornish prince appeared. He did not doubt the prince's word. "I am sorry I could not see you until now or meet Princess Myrcella," Martell had said when Aris was admitted to his solar. "But I trust that my daughter Ariane has made you welcome here in Dorne, sir." "She has, my prince," he'd answered, and prayed that no blush would dare betray him. "Ours is a harsh land, and poor, yet not without its beauties. It grieves us that you have seen no more of Dorne than Sunspear, but I fear that neither you nor your princess would be safe beyond these walls. We Dornish are a hot-blooded people, quick to anger and slow to forgive. It would gladden my heart if I could assure you that the Sand Snakes were alone in wanting war, but I will not tell you lies, sir. You have heard my small folk in the streets crying out for me to call my spears. Half my lords agree with them, I fear." "And you, my prince?" the knight had dared to ask. "My mother taught me long ago that only madmen fight wars they cannot win." If the bluntness of the question had offended him, Prince Doran hid it well. "Yet this peace is fragile as your princess. Only a beast would harm a little girl. My sister Elia had a little girl as well. Her name was Rhaenys. She was a princess too." The prince sighed. "Those who would plunge a knife into Princess Myrcella do not bear her any malice, no more than Sir Aemery Lorch did when he killed Rhaenys, if indeed he did. They seek only to force my hand, for if Myrcella should be slain in Dorne whilst under my protection, who would believe my denials? No one shall ever harm Myrcella whilst I live." "A noble vow," said Doran Martell with a faint smile, "but you are but only one man, sir. I had hoped that imprisoning my headstrong nieces would help to calm the waters, but all we've done is drive the roaches back beneath the rushes. Every night I hear them whispering and sharpening their knives." "He is afraid," Sir Aris realized then. "Look, his hand is shaking. The Prince of Dorne is terrified." Words failed him. "My apologies, sir," Prince Doran said. "I am frail and failing, and sometimes Sunspear wearies me with its noise and dirt and smells. As soon as my duty allows, I mean to return to the water gardens. When I do, I shall take Princess Myrcella with me." Before the knight could protest, the prince raised a hand, its knuckles red and swollen. "You shall go as well, and her scepter, her maids, her guards. Sunspear's walls are strong, but beneath them is the Shadow City. Even within the castle, hundreds come and go each day. The gardens are my haven. Prince Maron raised them as a gift for his Targaryen bride, to mark Dorne's marriage to the Iron Throne. Autumn is a lovely season there. Hot days, cool nights, the salt breeze off the sea, the fountains and the pools. And there are other children, boys and girls, of high and gentle birth. Myrcella will have friends of her own age to play with. She will not be lonely." "As you say." The prince's words pounded in his head. "She will be safe there." Only why had Doran Martell urged him not to write King's Landing about the move? Myrcella will be safest if no one knows just where she is. Sir Aris had agreed, but what choice did he have? He was a knight of the King's Guard, but only one man for all that, just as the prince had said. The alley opened suddenly onto a moonlit courtyard. Past the candlemaker's shop, she wrote, a gate and a short flight of exterior steps. He pushed through the gate and climbed the worn steps to an unmarked door. Should I knock? He pushed the door open instead and found himself in a large, dim room with a low ceiling lit by a pair of scented candles that flickered in niches, cut from the